Emperor Josh Frydenberg is claiming that the economy is bouncing back in a big way, but he's not so keen to talk about the 3 million Australians living in poverty. For a brief moment last year, the coronavirus supplement meant people on benefits could pay their bills and put food on the table. But now the Liberals are turning the screws on people who depend on benefits once again. I'm talking to two people today about poverty in Australia. First up is Marcus Banks, a former Commonwealth Employment Service worker and union militant, and now a university researcher. And later I'll be talking with Lachlan McGowan, a member of the Australian Unemployed Workers Union. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity, a revolutionary socialist group in Australia. If you'd like to find out more, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Melbourne. Marcus, welcome.
Hello, Dave. How are you?
First up, can you paint me a picture of poverty in Australia? Because most of the time we get the message that this is a lucky country and we are coming back from the pandemic in a good way.
Well, the poverty has been increasing in Australia. The reality of poverty is that you don't have enough money to meet your day-to-day living. I've interviewed lots and lots of people for the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence and other people. And the big thing that you get when you talk to people is that they're worried that their payments from Centrelink or their sessional work, casual work that they've done won't be enough or won't be there on time to meet their commitments to pay the rent, to pay back loans that they've got, or maybe family borrowings that they've had. The reality of poverty is that you retreat into yourself and that you don't find ways of being able to build the confidence that you need to go out in the world. And I think that that's the worst thing about poverty.
And is the poverty, I mentioned the figure of 3 million, is that poverty concentrated amongst people who essentially are poor all their lives? Or are we talking about people falling into poverty and then bouncing back out?
We've had times in Australian history where the unemployment rate has been below 2%. And we've had times even last year in August, according to some measures of when you have the rate of poverty defined, that nobody was poor, that the state was able to, with the JobKeeper and other payments that were around, at least for a few months, there was no poverty in Australia by and large, though other communities were still suffering. But in the broad brush, poverty is a decision that's made by governments. It's made by labour markets. It's made by employers and it's made by the government. People drop in and out. We did some research around Newstart allowance and found twice as many people receive Newstart allowance in any given year than what the figures would indicate. So there's millions of people who receive income support payments. It's a standard part of life for most working class people to have at least somebody in their household most of the time receiving an income support payment. There's research from the University of Melbourne, survey data that shows that 70% of Australian households receive, somebody in that household receives an income support payment at least once in every 10-year period. These do not include payments like the age pension. These are just working age payments. It doesn't include childcare benefit, doesn't include family tax benefit. So 70% of Australian households, basically working class households, have a member in that household who's received an income support payment in any given 10-year period. And our research backs that up when we looked at Newstart allowance, because we found that twice as many people receive Newstart allowance in any year than what's generally recognised. So it's a mainstream part of working class life that Australian households rely, somebody in them relies on the social security system on a regular basis. And so it is not something just for, you know, this group of long-term unemployed. It's something that everybody needs, whether it's a disability support pension, whether it's a single parent payment, whether it's Newstart allowance. These are payments that are mainstream in working class life.
You basically are arguing, and I agree with you, that poverty is not natural. It's not something that just happens, as I'm sure the rich and the wealthy would like to believe. And it's not a product of individual weaknesses or what they used to call fecklessness. It's a choice, because it was abolished last year for a brief period. I saw some figures. They were actually in an article by an RMIT researcher, David Haywood, a professor of public policy. He wrote a very interesting article in The Age, which pointed out some figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics that said during the pandemic, and I'm quoting here from the article, once account is taken of changes in welfare payments, taxes and government-funded services, the share of disposable income going to the bottom one-fifth of households leapt from 4% to almost 12%. And then you go through the scale, and at the top, the richest one-fifth of society, their share of disposable income fell by 12.7%. Now, before we panic for people in Toorak and Vaucluse and so on, that doesn't mean they lost money. They lost a relative share of disposable income, but it meant for the people at the bottom of the scale, as you said, a huge change in their living circumstances. What's stopping governments doing that again right now?
Because the Australian state is about maximising the rate of exploitation amongst working class people. That's the basic reason. Health, welfare, education has to be delivered as cheaply as possible, but sufficiently so that there are enough socialised, educated and trained people that will work. There's a general understanding that what's so-called welfare, the benefit of welfare is really for poor people. And I think if you step back and see the purpose of the social security system is benefiting capitalism, then I think you're on firmer ground there, because you don't want to have too many sick people. You don't want to have too many people that are so poor that they have to resort to crime, or that their kids can't go to school, or are poorly educated. So, you know, if you ask the question, who benefits from the health system? Who benefits from the education, the public education system? And who benefits from public welfare? You've got to have a two-pronged answer to that. It's capitalism at the most fundamental level that requires welfare system and requires a health system and requires an education system so that they can have a next generation of workers come into their offices, come into their call centres, come into their factories and drive the transport, because otherwise the wheels of profit will be gummed up.
But at the same time, Karl Marx talked 150 odd years ago about capitalism relying on a reserve army of labour, of the unemployed, deliberately fostering a level of unemployment in order to discipline the rest of the working class. So if you and Marx are both right, what we're talking about is a balancing act where they want enough skilled workers, healthy and educated enough to come to work, but they also want some workers to be suffering it to act as a discipline on the rest of the working class. Is that right?
I think that's only half right, because Marx didn't talk about what happened in the 1890s and after Marx had died, which was the role of the state in the accumulation of capital and supporting national capitals competing on the world market. Because during the Crimean War, the problem that was faced by the military, British military, the soldiers had terrible teeth. They were very short and they were pretty sickly, and it meant that British imperialist intentions were undermined by the quality of their military force. And that goes more generally across, you know, the whole workforce in Britain at the time. And it's no coincidence that after people had come out of the, you know, what would Marx would call the primitive accumulation capital phase, where people could be drawn out of the countryside into the cities, and that they could have a reserve there. But after a while, there weren't any more people in the countryside to be able to draw on. It didn't matter for many decades while that process was going on that lots of kids were put into the coal mines and died. It didn't matter that women in childbirth quite often died. But it all came to a head in the 1890s with the Depression, because there was mass death that went on inside the slums in London, and similarly in Sydney and in Melbourne. Infanticide skyrocketed to the highest record in Australian history. I don't know about in Britain. There was a need for the Australian state to be able to bring in public education, bring in public welfare systems, and bring in the health system as well.
So how do we explain then the fact that welfare payments are set at a level where really long-term people can't survive? They may be able to pay for food and bills this week, but if the fridge breaks down or the car needs a major service or whatever, they just don't have money in reserve. And in relation to that, another interesting little thing about the Australian Bureau of Statistics that's just been talked about in the media, they are now measuring inflation on two different levels. One on the essentials of life and one on basically luxuries. And the level of inflation on the essentials is twice as high as it is on the luxuries. And yet we know that somebody struggling to get by on a benefit is really at best only just close to covering their essential costs. So the state may want that guarantee of a healthy, educated workforce, but they're also treating people on benefits either as disposable, or they're punishing them in order to drive them into low-paid, unorganised jobs.
Yeah, and I think that's where the ACTU has come in, because it hasn't fought hard for increasing the minimum wage, because the gap between the minimum wage and social security payments, this is what economically would push people towards getting work. Fighting for a decent minimum wage is essential, as well as fighting for a better social security payments. But what people do is they borrow. It was really interesting in August and September last year when people, could get enough money to be able to not only buy food, but also buy some, what do-gooding middle-class people would say would be a luxury, buying some Nike shoes for your 12-year-old or buying an Essendon footy jumper. These are two things that people did mention to me when I was interviewing people a couple of years ago. Buying a proper Essendon football jumper. That is so important for that 12-year-old to go to school with a jumper on that is not being handmade by, his sister or mother. That is a question of dignity that, in my view and in their view, was essential. Or going to McDonald's on a Friday night for your birthday party. If they can't afford to do that, they still do it by borrowing money. And the interesting thing in August and September last year was, who was crying poor? It was cash converters. It was Money3. It was the payday lenders, because their income was dropping by about 50%, according to a couple of these loan sharks. Which is a strong indication that that's how people do survive. Is they borrow from their friends and family, but they have to pay it back at some point, or there's massive tensions at home. Or they can borrow from Centrelink, but that cuts down their next 12 payments that they get from Centrelink by that amount. Or they can borrow from a payday lender. And so, that's what people do. They just try to make ends meet any way they can. And there's a lot of clever ways that people do that, bulk buying, all sorts of different techniques and tactics that people do. So it's not because people are stupid. Poor people are stupid. They're probably the best budgeters of anybody. So the economists, if they want to know the realities of how to manage your money, they should just talk to anybody that's on Newstart Allowance.
You used to be in the public service in the what used to be called the CES.
And also Centrelink.
And you were a union militant for many years. What's it like for those working in the sector at the moment? Bearing in mind, of course, that many of those jobs have essentially been privatised to private job-finding agencies. What do you hear about the reality on the other side of the counter?
Well, it's been fear and loathing forever, ever since John Howard set up Centrelink in 1996. It was called the Commonwealth Services Delivery Agency then. Who did they put in charge? Sue Varden. There's the CEO, because they had it as a quasi-privatised sort of thing then. She ran the prisons in South Australia. That was her qualification. Who else did they have on? They had on the guy who was the CEO of Aristocrat Leisure, the gaming machine, you know, one of the biggest gaming machine companies in the world. They had on another guy who smashed the electrical trade unions in South Australia when they privatised the electric cable lines in South Australia. He was a lead figure there. So it was an ideological assault on working class people getting Newstart allowance. It was translated across to that. When I did my research into comparing each side, what was called each side of the workfare desk, a PhD I did, I compared the performance plan of the Centrelink worker that was required to be done to the mutual obligation plan on the other side of the desk. They're very similar, same words, same things that you had to do. And so, you know, the argument I always made at work in Centrelink was we have far more in common with people we're working with than we do with our managers and obviously with our government. And every time anybody stepped up at work and got into trouble, I would always argue that we have to look after everybody at work and we have to collectively respond to any problems that they're getting and back them up. And the same with people on the other side of the counter. Now, the stronger union officers meant that there was less shit that unemployed people had to put up with. But I'm not trying to minimise it. Unemployed people still had to put up with a lot of shit when they went into Centrelink. You know, you put up a class argument there and it helps cut through some of the stigma and the stereotyping that goes on amongst both unemployed people and people who work in Centrelink.
Talking of what people have to put up with, it strikes me that on the left, we don't often enough raise the argument against means testing and that benefits, whether they're age benefits, unemployment, whatever, should be available to everyone. But this should be compensated on the other side of the ledger by higher taxes on the rich. What's the damage that you've seen done by means testing, both financially and psychologically?
Well, the age pension until, I think it was 75, was not means tested. Everybody got it, and the taxation system reflected that. It only became a means tested payment after then. The blind pension is still not means tested. Which is an interesting outlier in the general movement towards mutual obligation. So the idiocy and the stupidity of applying for 20 jobs a fortnight is pure disciplinary attack. I remember newly arriving, you know, or been here for a couple of years, gentlemen, quite a few of them, came in to Centrelink because they couldn't get their qualification, you know, work in the areas where their qualifications come in. They come in suits, you know, with a briefcase, a business briefcase, and they would do those 20 job applications every fortnight. And you would see after a few months, they're picking up that that's all bullshit and that they needed to do what other people did to survive and just make up stuff. Because nobody ever looked at it at my workplace, I know that. They just never looked at it. And so there's a sort of a culture, you know, that is not necessarily understood about how to actually live if you're receiving an income support payment with mutual obligation.
And there must be a gigantic bureaucratic waste that goes into the policing of means testing.
I think it's all that. I'm unpopular of the view that universal basic income, because it's people talk about it as being the panacea of, but to be able to pay, you know, everybody should be paid a pension rate at the proper, that would be the minimum you would think to be able to survive, for more than a couple of months. And universal basic income's not going to do that. It's only a proportion of that. And it also lets off the hook the political campaign, industrial campaigns that are needed to be able to fight, to put on the same criteria. They fought against, you know, fought to sort of privatise Medicare, and in 76, the Medicare strike occurred, I think it was that year, and there was a massive response to the trade union movement. The same sort of response is needed around income support, and because they're both essential for a decent working class standard of living. It's what you could call the social wage. It's the component. You get a private wage and you get a social wage. And the trade union movement needs to get on top of that in a way that it hasn't been able to. And the last time that there was a huge fight about it, it required revolutionary politics to do that. It required the Communist Party in the 30s to fight for the dole, to get the dole in the first place. So I don't know if it needs to have a revolutionary group, you know, organisation that's big enough and ugly enough to do that and widespread enough to be able to do that today. But it certainly needs a social movement that's linked to the strength of the trade union movement to talk about income support payment in ways that are not, you know, this disparaging idea of welfare needs to be rejected and saying that this is for our standard of living, that we need decent health, we need decent public education, and we need decent public social assistance when we need it. You know, I suppose that the other side, apart from the 30s where the dole was won, was in the late 60s and early 70s, where the social movements against, you know, the Vietnam War, women's liberation movement, disability rights movement came up like a rocket. You know, in the late 60s, 9 out of 10 unmarried women who had a baby gave up their babies for adoption. 10 years later, due primarily to campaigns by women to get the single mother's benefit, and they had fantastic campaigns. They had they went into ministers' offices and other, you know, parliamentary offices and put down a picnic blanket. And 5 or 10 of them would bring all their kids with them and they would let the kids run wild and they'd have a picnic. It just caused this big campaign to develop, and so they got the single parents benefit in the early 70s. I think it's the most telling indication of the women's liberation movement and the impact it had was that, you know, in the late 60s, 9 out of 10 unmarried mothers who had a baby gave them up for adoption. 10 years later, it was the exact opposite. 9 out of 10 women who were not married did not give up their kids for adoption. They kept them. They could afford to keep them as well because of the single parents benefit, but they felt the right to keep up their kids as well. Miss Australia, who is from South Australia, came over to Melbourne during the campaign by the Single Mothers, Council for Single Mothers and Their Children, it was called the campaign group. And she got on the front page of the Herald, which was an afternoon daily at the time, saying, "I will keep my baby." This was in 1973, I think, that she that was on the front page of the Herald. And she led that campaign along with a lot of other single parents, and it was driven that way. I just think that the impact of social movements can be profound on both fighting for the money to survive and also the attitude about, you know, the changing social attitudes about what it is to have children. And I think that that was even more powerful to me than the campaign against the Vietnam War.
Well, that's a fantastic note to finish on. Thank you very much for your time, Marcus.
Thanks, Dave.
My second guest today is Lachlan McGowan. Lachlan is a member of the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, and he's speaking to us today from unceded Ngunnawal land in Canberra. So welcome, Lachlan.
G'day, comrades.
I want to kick off by talking about poverty, because for a very brief period last year, when the Liberals were forced to take emergency measures with the pandemic, and they brought in the coronavirus supplement, which pretty much doubled the level of job seeker, for a brief period, as I think we've mentioned earlier in the program, poverty was abolished. Now, that isn't the case today, despite the $50 increase in the base rate of job seeker. So can you paint a little bit of a picture of the problems that your members and more broadly people on job seeker and benefits are facing?
The main problems that we are facing returning poverty to people on job seeker with reducing the rate is everyone is suffering from all sorts of different health problems. Various health problems that you can't fix without money, that the Medicare system is not adequate to fix. So we have a lot of people with mental health problems, a lot of people who need physiotherapy or other forms of disability therapy. And there are so many therapies on that in Australia now that are no longer covered by Medicare, or that Medicare only offers like 5 sessions. Well, it's something that you need once a week to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So that really is the main thing we're hearing about, is health problems. And tying into that, we're also hearing a lot about suicidality. A lot of people unfortunately were feeling much less suicidal during the coronavirus supplement, have been experiencing worsening mental health. We're also seeing a lot of people having problems with food, which, you know, it does tie into the health thing as well, but it can be very difficult, depending on where you live, to find like healthy food and decent housing with the pitiful amount that we're paid from JobSeeker. And so a lot of people are having to skip meals or survive off instant noodles and other such cheap foods. Yeah, housing is still a problem. Housing was a problem even when the coronavirus supplement was out, of course, because Australia has so many problems with its housing supply right now, and rents are universally through the roof. And, of course, that's gotten worse. So we are, at the moment, I think that's something that's going to, the exact impacts of that aren't going to be clear for at least another few months. But I think we are going to be seeing a fairly sharp rise in homelessness in the next few months when we start seeing figures about that, just because people won't be able to afford rental properties anymore.
Have you seen any flow-on effects in terms of women trying to leave domestic violence situations? Because housing is absolutely critical to allow women to make that choice to leave, especially if they have children.
We don't have any numbers on that sort of thing. It is certainly something that we are predicting will happen as an effect. Again, that's a problem with the social security system. Even when we did have the coronavirus supplement, it can be very difficult to separate your payments if you are in a relationship and getting paid jointly. It can be very difficult to convince the government that you want to separate and to get exclusive access to your account instead of allowing either one of you to access the account. Even with the supplement, the system is not kind to people who are in people who need to escape from abusive relationships.
Now, the sector in general has responded by raising the demand for 80 a day. Can you take us through why 80 a day, and who's supporting it, and how is the campaign going?
The reason that we use 80 a day as our campaign number is firstly because that is the rate that we were receiving during the peak of the coronavirus supplement when it was first introduced. And secondly, it's to do with the Henderson poverty line. The Henderson poverty line is the best measurement we have of relative poverty in Australia. It was commissioned by the Whitlam government in 1973. Melbourne University produces it, one of their research institutes. After the dismissal, the government, both Labor and Liberal, walked away from the Henderson poverty line. The government currently has no official definition of poverty, but the Melbourne Institute at Melbourne Uni does continue to produce the Henderson poverty line reports. During 2020, 80 a day was the Henderson poverty line. It has actually increased. It's now something like $83 or $84 a day. But we keep the 80 a day campaign because it has strong momentum.
And who's come in behind the campaign?
So the campaign was partially set up by the Unemployed Workers Union. We've also received support on the campaign from various councils of social services and other social service peak bodies. Some of them have actually backed down from the campaign, unfortunately. Some of them are only calling for 65, which is still below Henderson. I believe that they're calculating their own poverty line, but they're not publishing those calculations, so we can't be especially sure of its accuracy. 80 a day was, it has been adopted as policy by the Greens. I do believe that that is something they have picked up from the Unemployed Workers Union and other activists on the left. GetUp, the organisation, has also supported us quite a lot. And some of the unions have been supporting the Unemployed Workers Union. It's a little bit divisive. The Unemployed Workers Union doesn't get along with Unions Australia and the peak trade union bodies, but there are some individual unions that support us, like CFMEU Canberra had a big presence at the 80 a day protest in Canberra. On the other hand, I grew up in Newcastle where the CFMEU were terrible. So I think it varies from site to site, from state to state, which unions are actually supporting the 80 a day movement. But there's at least some support coming from the trade union bodies.
And the elephant hiding in the corner of the room, hoping no one will see it there, is, of course, the Labor Party, who say they're for more, but never quite put a figure on it. Have you got people inside the Labor Party who are sympathetic to the campaign?
It's very difficult to be sure of that at the moment. The Labor Party, their communication strategy seems to be to lock the left faction down and don't let them say a word. Yeah, they're letting Fitzgibbon run off his mouth about whatever he likes, but they do seem to be keeping the left faction down. And their welfare policy seems to be, oh, I guess we'd like to increase it, but we'd need to form a committee, to form a subcommittee, to produce a report, to produce a white paper, to investigate the possibility, rather than just saying, yeah, we'll raise the rate. Now, of course, the problem with that kind of attitude is that we kind of need the money now. We actually, like, the longer it takes to raise the rate, the more people are going to suffer.
Absolutely. So, I mean, as ever, it comes down to the weight of the campaign on the ground. Obviously, if you were able to shift more unions into your camp, that could well have an impact on the Labor Party. But
yeah, it's a possibility. There are some very, very strange arguments that go on social, on Twitter, about where the AUWU stands. We're variously accused of being a Green PSYOP or a Liberal PSYOP against the Labor Party. But I think that the problem is that we're actually making concrete demands from the left, and the Labor Party's not used to facing concrete demands at the moment.
Now, I just thought perhaps we could move on to talk about mutual obligation. The very concept is hugely problematic because it implies that people getting benefits are leeching off the state and therefore have to give something back in return. And the way it operates can be capricious and cruel. I'm on JobSeeker. A couple of weeks ago, I was told that I hadn't applied for a broad enough range of jobs and was told to apply for 7 more, or else I'd lose benefit. So if you apply for a job as a brain surgeon or a truck driver and you're not qualified for either of them, you can be dobbed in for time wasting. But if you apply only for the jobs you're skilled for, then you can be punished for not looking more broadly. Now, that's just my experience. I'm sure you've got a lot more stories you could tell.
The basic idea of the mutual obligation system, well, first of all, as you said, the word mutual is completely inappropriate because it is all the demand is placed on the job seekers. We're the ones who have all the obligations while the corporations get all the benefits. But basically what happens in the mutual obligation system is that we have various private companies that do Centrelink's dirty work. Some of those companies are secular charities, some of them are religious, and some of them are for-profit entities. The for-profit entities are the ones where we get the real nightmare stories, but we rarely hear anything good, no matter who's organising the mutual obligations. But basically, we need to, at least once a fortnight, visit one of these private entities. We need to prove to them that we have applied for some absurd number of jobs per fortnight, and they will very often force us to do either some pointless training course that they arrange, which is always a absolute lowest common denominator training, stuff like how to spell check your resume or how to tie a tie. And they also force us into the Work for the Dole program if on occasion. The way these companies work is that the government pays them a quite sizable bounty for literally anything they do. They get a bounty for helping us find work, but they also get a bounty for putting us into one of those classes or into Work for the Dole. They get a bounty for, I don't believe it's confirmed they get a bounty for pushing us off our payments, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did. And on top of that, the job applications per month thing, it actually is causing damage to business, because there are businesses that are not capable of receiving the huge flood of applications that the mutual obligation system demands. They have to use arbitrary methods to check through their job applications instead of actually being able to choose the best candidate. They are forced by the mutual obligation system to choose candidates at random, which makes things worse for everyone. Even the party, allegedly the party of business, the Liberal Party, is making things harder for businesses because they really, really want to punish job seekers for being unemployed.
Absolutely. And now there's a new threat. In fact, as we speak, Parliament is debating a bill which, according to the Liberals, is going to streamline social security law and reduce the administrative burden for welfare recipients. But there's a real sting in the tail that it's going to lead to most new job seekers losing $450 on average. Can you tell us a bit about this legislation and why it's such a threat?
The way the monetary loss works is, at the moment, once your application is approved by Centrelink, once your application for welfare is approved, then you will start receiving payments, and then they will get you into mutual obligations after you've started receiving payments. The big change that the bill is making, and the reason it's going to make us lose the average of $450 on a new claim, is that when we make a claim, we are not going to start receiving payments until we enter the mutual obligation system. So Centrelink will, you know, look at your claim and approve it, but they won't backdate your pay. You'll have to go straight from Centrelink to a job agency, to one of these private job agencies, and you will have to sign their contract before you actually start receiving pay. Now, the enforcement of these contracts has yet to be challenged in court. The Unemployed Workers Union believes that the contracts would be found unlawful if they were ever actually challenged, but of course that would require us to afford lawyers to take it to the High Court.
This isn't a small number of people. The Department of Employment has told a Senate inquiry that they expect this to affect 144,000 people a year, because of course there are lots of people who come in and out of the system. And each time you come in, you're going to have to jump this hurdle. So we're talking about really substantial effect. And if the average is 450, they're obviously assuming that some very vulnerable people, people without internet access or people who have behavioural difficulties or whatever, may be much, much slower in signing up.
That's the thing. Like, the quote-unquote streamlining is that they are moving more of the mutual obligations to purely online systems. But of course, that means that if you are not able to access a purely online system, then you are not able to access JobKeeper. If you do have some disability or vulnerability that makes it more difficult for you to use the internet, then you can't get JobSeeker. Or for that matter, if you have some disability or some difficulty in actually reaching a mutual obligations office, then you're also going to have more difficulty with accessing JobSeeker. The people that this is really going to hurt, who are going to really be on the high end of that average $450 loss, are going to be people in the country who don't have good internet and can't easily reach a job active, a mutual obligations office, because then they can't get the money because they can't sign a job plan.
I'm sure Barnaby Joyce is looking after them as we speak, he said sarcastically. I'm intrigued a little bit. You were talking about how the private job agencies make a lot of money for doing very little. This change will see a lot of people transferred purely onto an online environment rather than going through a private job agency. What's the UWU's position on that? Is that a step forward or a step back? Or
that's an interesting one. I believe that these online services are largely going to be managed by the job agencies, so we expect very little. The AUWU's position is that the online that all the job agencies should be abolished and returned to public hands, as they were back when the Commonwealth Employment Service existed.
Thanks very much for joining me today, Lachlan. How can people get involved in the UWU if they've been fired up by this conversation?
If you are an unemployed person, membership is free because we don't expect dues from people who can barely afford to eat, of course. There is the option of what we call the solidarity membership, which is for those people who can afford to pay a membership, people who are in employment. Our Twitter presence is where we have the most active members. So if you follow the OSS Unemployment Twitter with no spaces, you can visit the website as well, which is auwu.org.au. Most of the organisation is done at the level of local chapters, so if you do have a local chapter of the AUWU, please join up. At the moment, our biggest local chapters are the Melbourne, the Illawarra and the Canberra chapters, but we are, of course, always trying to organise them in new regions. There's a few more trying to get set up in New South Wales and Queensland.
Thank you for joining us, Lachlan, and good luck, comrade.
Yeah, thank you very much, comrade. And I do hope that things improve for the unemployed of Australia sooner rather than later.